Welcome to the Community Oncology Journal podcast for June 2012. I'm Dr. David Henry. This month we have two commentaries on the new drug ruxolitinib and its approval for treating myelofibrosis. We then have an original research article on recurrence and survival in women with early stage triple negative breast cancer, followed by a wonderful, thorough, and very readable review by Dr. Robert Haddad on medullary thyroid cancer and the advances in treatment and management of this uncommon tumor type. Professor Cornelius Waller from Freiburg, Germany, reviews biosimilars and their use in hematology and oncology, followed by a very timely review article by Dr. Valerie R. Kusch on the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, entitled No Rhetoric, Just the Facts. So let's begin. Ruxolitinib, Juggling Cancer Biology and Survival Outcomes in Myelofibrosis, by Dr. Manish Sharma from Temple University in Philadelphia. Staging and risk assessment can now be performed for primary myelofibrosis with the Dynamic International Prognostic Scoring System, or DIPSS. This risk assessment tool is based on 8 parameters, and they include age, thrombocytopenia, anemia, red cell transfusion needs, constitutional symptoms, leukocytosis, karyotype, and circulating blast count. The JAK2 mutation, V617F, occurs in many patients with primary myelofibrosis and is the target mutation for the ruxolitinib. 2 recently published phase 3 trials describe its use as a JAK2 inhibitor in primary myelofibrosis. Unfortunately, the drug's main outcome seems to be symptom improvement. There was no improvement in overall survival. The best use of ruxolitinib might be in those patients who are ineligible for allogeneic transplant and who are considered high surgical risk for a splenectomy. In these patients, symptom improvement from splenomegaly and or constitutional symptoms, especially itching, can be impressive in many patients. A follow-on article in our community translation section by Dr. James Abram is entitled Ruxolitinib Treatment for Myelofibrosis. For those patients with high DIPSS scores, the recommended starting dose of ruxolitinib is 20 milligrams orally twice daily if platelet count is over 200,000, and 15 milligrams twice daily if platelet count is between 100 and 200,000. The most common adverse drug reactions included thrombocytopenia, anemia, bruising, dizziness, and headache. In the double-blind studies recently reported, a 35% or greater reduction in spleen volume at 24 weeks occurred in 42% of ruxolitinib patients and only 0.7% of placebo patients. A 50% reduction in symptom score occurred in 46% of ruxolitinib patients, compared with only 5% of placebo-treated patients. These data and the approach to your next myelofibrosis patient are nicely summarized by Dr. Abram in a How I Treat Myelofibrosis insert in this article. Cancer recurrence and survival in patients with early-stage triple-negative breast cancer, or TNBC, by Dr. Neil Christensen and colleagues from the Georgia Cancer Specialists. These authors reviewed their patient database from 2003 to 2008 in stage 1 through 3 breast cancer patients who were triple negative and received adjuvant chemotherapy. 1,572 patients were reviewed, of whom 26% had the TNBC phenotype. The 5-year disease-free survival was 77% for TNBC and 89% for non-TNBC patients. 5-year recurrence rates were 18% for TNBC and 11% for non-TNBC. African-American ethnic background was an independent risk factor for worse outcome. TNBC accounts for 10 to 17% of all breast cancer patients in the U.S. TNBC has a particularly aggressive disease course, with tumors tending to be larger at diagnosis and higher risk for recurrence or death in the first 5 years after diagnosis. This retrospective review from the Georgia Cancer Specialists highlights this worse prognosis and earlier recurrence in TNBC patients and leaves the door open for better and or more aggressive therapies in this patient subtype. Medullary thyroid cancer, advances in treatment and management of common adverse events associated with therapy, by Dr. Robert Haddad and Rosemary Costello from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, Massachusetts. Thyroid cancer is the most common malignancy of the endocrine system. Medullary thyroid cancer, or MTC, is an intermediate differentiation pathologic subtype of thyroid cancer and accounts for only 4% of all thyroid cancer cases in the U.S. MTC thyroid cancers have increased activation of the proto-oncogene RET, R-E-T, which encodes a receptor tyrosine kinase promoting cell growth, differentiation, and survival. RET mutations are present in almost all patients with hereditary MTC and up to 50% of patients with sporadic MTC. These tumors overexpress VEGF receptors. Several oral tyrosine kinase inhibitors have been investigated for the treatment of patients with MTC, and recently venetinib was approved in the U.S. for treatment of this thyroid cancer type in local or advanced metastatic disease. There are some common side effects with this TKI inhibitor class that we should watch for, and they include diarrhea, rash, hypertension, and QT prolongation. Efficacy and tolerability of venetinib 100 mg or 300 mg daily, sunitinib 50 mg 4 weeks out of 6, sorafenib 800 mg daily, and mutesinib 125 mg daily were studied in phase 2 clinical trials of patients with advanced MTC. All of these therapies had promising efficacy and were generally well tolerated. And again, the most common adverse events in the venetinib placebo-controlled trial were diarrhea or colitis, 56%, rash, 45%, nausea, 33%, hypertension, 32%, and headache, 26%, with the QTC prolongation occurring at 8%. This beautiful review by Dr. Haddad has several very useful tables on symptom management of these common adverse events from venetinib. These tables can be viewed and saved easily on your computer or smartphone device by visiting our website at communityoncology.net. That's all one word, communityoncology.net. Biosimilars and their use in hematology and oncology by Professor Cornelius Waller from the Freiburg University in Freiburg, Germany. Biosimilars are by definition not the original brand product of an approved medication, but they are similar in composition, efficacy, and adverse effect profile. However, definitions need to be offered and tightened to allow companies interested in biosimilar production to make an identical or nearly so product. The European Union, the EU, has generated guidelines for a biosimilar medicinal product as a copy version of an authorized biologic medicine known as the reference product, which demonstrates similarity through a comprehensive, compatible exercise to the reference product in terms of physical and chemical characteristics, efficacy, and safety. Interestingly, in the EU, if clinical similarity is approved for one indication, then the European Medicines Agency, the EMA, which is the European FDA equivalent, endorses the concept of data extrapolation to other indications as long as the mode of action is the same in those indications. Using these guidelines, a number of products have been approved in the EU and include somatotropin, epoetin alpha, epoetin zeta, and filgrastim. In the U.S., the Biologics Price Competition and Innovation Act, BPCI Act, part of the U.S. Affordable Care Act, was enacted in March 2010. Our FDA is still considering draft rules for actual biosimilar development in the U.S., but those guidelines still are to be finalized. In the U.K., the biosimilar Nivestim, which is filgrastim, was approved after a phase 3 randomized double-blind therapeutic equivalency study. In this study, the primary endpoint was duration of severe neutropenia, and this biosimilar performed virtually identically to the filgrastim reference product. Likewise, two biosimilar epoetins, epoetin alpha and epoetin zeta, have proven similar efficacy to their reference products and are now marketed under five separate names in Europe after approval by the EMA. The comparative efficacy trials were in patients with renal failure-induced anemia. Although comparative efficacy studies would not be required for chemotherapy-induced anemia, the effectiveness and safety of one product, Retacrit, in chemotherapy-induced anemia was demonstrated in an open-label 12-week phase 3 study in some 216 patients. Hemoglobin augmentation, transfusion decrease, and quality of life improvements were identical between Retacrit and the referenced epoetin alpha product. Biosimilar medications offer the promise of significant financial savings. The EU estimates that if only 7 conventional biopharmaceuticals were replaced by their biosimilar medications, then 2 billion euros could be saved. The next hurdle for biosimilars will be monoclonal antibodies, which are larger and more difficult to produce. The comparability exercises will likewise be more challenging, but biosimilar manufacturers are gearing up to perform these trials. The first EU biosimilar monoclonal antibody will likely be infliximab, trade name Remicade in the States. And finally, we have a very timely review article submitted by Dr. Valerie Arkush from the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine entitled, "The Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, No Rhetoric, Just the Facts." So this act, the PPACA, also known as Obamacare, was signed into law on March 23, 2010. It was designed to expand access to health insurance to the uninsured, provide enhanced consumer protection for those with private health insurance, stabilize and close gaps in the Medicare program, prioritize preventive care, establish the personal responsibility to have health insurance, and explore delivery systems that will award quality of care and patient outcomes. The implementation of the law began in September 2010 and will continue until its final implementation in January 2014. How will the law expand access to health care and insurance? It is estimated 32 million Americans are uninsured and will gain access to health care insurance coverage under the PPAC Act. 6 mechanisms are proposed to accomplish this, and they include Medicaid expansion, enhanced consumer protection in the private health insurance market, the requirement for large employers to offer insurance or pay a fine, tax credits to increase the affordability of insurance for small businesses, new creation of state-based competitive marketplaces where the uninsured can shop for insurance, and the individual mandate to enroll in a health insurance plan. So let's look at these one at a time. Medicaid expansion. Medicaid will now cover individuals and families with modified adjusted gross income under 133% of the federal poverty level, which was $30,657 in 2012 standards. The cost of this Medicaid care will be covered 100% by federal dollars for the first 3 years, after which the states will be required to contribute a percentage, so that by 2020, federal funds will cover only 90% of the cost and the states will pick up the rest. 12 to 13 million uninsured Americans will benefit from this expansion. Next, consumer protections. Guaranteed insurability is one of the most popular provisions of this new law, which requires that pre-existing conditions be covered without waiting periods. This provision of the law will fully implement by January 2014, requiring that all consumers with few exceptions must be charged the same amount for insurance regardless of their health status or gender. Rescission, or the unmaking of an insurance contract whereby insurance carriers can deny coverage if a consumer develops an illness, is now illegal. Also, young adults 26 years or younger may remain on their parents' insurance plan. Another fascinating aspect of this consumer protection requirement is that insurance companies are now required to spend at least 80% of their premium dollar for individuals or smaller groups, or 85% of the premium dollar for larger groups, on healthcare expenses and quality improvements rather than administrative and marketing cost or profit. This August 2012, consumers will receive rebates if their insurance company did not achieve this medical loss ratio in 2011. For example, the Kaiser Family Foundation alone estimates it will be providing rebates of up to $1.3 billion under this law provision. And finally, health insurance plans have limits on premium increases of 10% or more from 1 year to the next. Perhaps the most controversial aspect of the new law is the individual mandate. Beginning January 2014, the law establishes the personal responsibility for every person to enroll in a health insurance plan or pay a penalty. The penalty for not enrolling will be the greater of $95 or 1% of taxable income. But this will rise by 2016. The penalty will be the greater of $695 or 2.5% of taxable income if the individual is not enrolled in an insurance health plan. As you know, on June 28 of this year, the Supreme Court ruled that this individual mandate provision is in fact constitutional under the law. Interestingly, the constitutionality referred to the mandate as a tax on consumers, maintaining that health care is essentially a universal need for every citizen, and therefore the government can tax citizens if they do not voluntarily obtain insurance coverage. How about caring for specific populations? Preventive care is greatly enhanced and follows the guidelines of the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. The unpopular Medicare Part D donut hole will close by 50% this year and entirely by 2020. Healthcare delivery system reforms. While the physician workforce will have incentives to expand under the new law, Medicare will provide bonus payments to primary care physicians and general surgeons who practice in shortage areas. A focus on quality rather than quantity of care. This is an area long under discussion, especially in oncology, where we have endeavored to make quality the goal rather than quantity of care. The most controversial feature of this aspect of the new law is the Accountable Care Organization, or ACO. ACOs will have facilities, institutions, and physicians joining forces together to be at risk for certain pre-specified and defined patient populations. This concept is still under development. Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute. Since March 2011, the PCORI, or Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, methodology committee has been working to define patient-centered outcomes research with significant public and provider input. Finally, how to pay for this PPACA Act. The Congressional Budget Office has consistently found that the PPACA is fully funded and will reduce the federal deficit over the next decade. However, unfortunately, this CBO evaluation assumes that the sustainable growth rate, or the SGR, cuts to physician Medicare reimbursement will occur. But as we know, these have not yet occurred and been repeatedly deferred by Congress. So this will remain an interesting feature yet to be decided in the new law. To help fund the PPACA as well, the law also creates new taxes of 2 to 2.5% on the pharmaceutical, medical device, and health insurance industries. Over time, as more uninsured are insured, hospitals will receive proportionally decreased payments to care for the uninsured since their numbers will be less. Taxpayer subsidies to Medicare Advantage plans will gradually be reduced and go away. Also, individuals and families earning more than $200,000 to $250,000 annually will pay almost 1% increase in their Medicare payable tax on their income above these thresholds. All in all, the PPACA, the so-called Obamacare, has more good fixes than bad where oncology is concerned, but we can count on one thing, and that's that the debates will continue. And that concludes this month's Community Oncology Journal podcast for June 2012. We welcome your comments and suggestions, especially on this controversial PPACA healthcare law. So please visit us at our website, communityoncology.net. to make your comments and suggestions known, and where you can also review old archived articles in previous issues of this journal. And thanks for listening.